Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Joy, stress, resilience, self-doubt. Joe Blair has experienced an extreme range of parental emotion with Michael, his autistic son. Actor Michael T. Williamson played Bubba in Forrest Gump, and you can see him now in NBC's Chicago PD. He reads Joe Blair's essay, For the Boy Who Makes Waves.
Prospective buyers must wonder about the hard-packed runway of dirt in our backyard where grass won't grow, and the hasp and the padlock on the refrigerator, and... Well, they must wonder why the gate on our 6-foot-high picket fence is permanently bolted shut. Deb and I hardly think about these things. We've been with Michael for 11 years. There are two runways inside the fence. One traces the edge of the house. The dog made this one. He sprints from window to window, tracking my location. Am I in the kitchen? Leaving the kitchen. Walking to the living room. Walking back to the kitchen. It might be cute if it weren't for the destroyed windowsills and muddy paw prints on the siding. The other runway, in the center of our tiny backyard, belongs to Michael. It's a 10-by-3-foot stretch of shiny earth. There are three layers of sod beneath it, each one representing Deb's hope that this time the grass will take hold. This time the grass will take hold. This time. First thing in the morning, whether at 2 or 6 or 8, you can depend on Mike finding one of my leather belts, sneaking out the back door, and starting to pace on that patch of dirt. A brown packed surface, hard on dry days, slick on rainy days. What could be better? A belt that if you grab it by the buckle and move it back and forth at a certain pace, will make sine wave after sine wave. Its tail lapping the ground ever so gently as it releases the previous wave into the universe. It is a mesmerizing thing. So absorbing, so incredibly fantastical that Mike can't help releasing loud shrieks of delight or agony or pent-up frustration or joy in that muddy patch, in that release into the universe. Usually he's naked. Yep. Or he'll only have boxer shorts on. He will be screaming or singing or howling in a high pitch. He is a supersonic Tarzan. An alarm clock that we cannot ignore because we have sleeping neighbors. One of us, Deb or I, cursing beneath our breath, will peel ourselves out of bed and hurry down the creaking stairway. Michael! We will say in our most authoritative voice, Michael, get in here. And Michael will drop the belt and do as we say. He will leave behind the thing he loves most, more than food, and he will do what we say. Until we're back in bed. And then he will return to his beautiful runway with his magical belt, and he will make the world understandable in his way. It is a poor substitute, we've learned, for the real thing. Ocean waves. When Mike first saw the ocean 2 summers ago on a beach in San Francisco, he was enthralled. He dropped the belt he always carries, threw himself on the sand that was warm and fine, and listened to the sound of the surf. It was as if he had finally found someone who spoke his language. The Pacific Ocean. We visited the beach every day for 5 days, but this was only vacation, and despite what boys want, vacations end. Soon Mike was back in Iowa, and it was the belt again, lapping against the brick walkway while he waited for the school bus with his father. One evening, Mike's twin sister, Lucy, said to Deb and me, "The teachers will think I'm stupid like Mike." "Mike is not stupid," Deb said. "Mom," Lucy said patiently, "you know what I mean." "Yes," Deb said, "I know what you mean. But you've got to know what I mean, too. Imagine if you found yourself in the middle of China somewhere and everyone was trying to talk to you, but you couldn't understand them. And everyone thought that you were stupid. But you were still just like you are. How would you feel?" I have had glimpses of the kind of man I should be. Such are the revelations we are afforded, passing glimpses like the small hidden pond you pass while driving on a road for the first time, suddenly opening up and then closing once again so that it can be instantly forgotten or recalled only in part. I've had glimpses. When I was 10, pray to God and ask for my challenge. "Give me my challenge," I would pray. "Give me my challenge." And at my lowest moments, I've thought, that was my mistake. I asked for it. These days, I rarely talk to Mike because he rarely responds in any way. You may think this is cruel, ignoring my own son, and if you were to spend one day with him, you might be full of energy and hope and goodwill, but I have been with him every day of his life for 11 years. My bad habit of ignoring my son has become so ingrained that our routine of non-communication has become something of a runway all its own. And I ignore the very things that fascinate Michael. The belt, the patch of dirt. Still, once in a while, we engage one another. Sometimes, for example, we play the blinking game. While lying next to each other, very close, Mike will look at me out of the corner of his eye, a sly smile playing across his face, and he will blink once. Then, in response, I will blink once. His smile will gain in radiance, and he will answer my blink with one blink of his own. This will go on for some time, whipping Mike up into a fit of laughter. But tonight, I lie next to Mike. It's 11, well past his bedtime. He's been laughing hysterically for at least an hour, which might seem cute to you, but to me, indicates that he's on the edge of a seizure. Our faces are very close in the dark. Mike likes it this way. Close. He is a beautiful boy. His eyes are large and liquid. His facial features are clean. The great challenge I asked for when I was a boy, lying in bed next to me, very close to my face. Faith is nothing other than an acceptance of eternity and at the same time of death. The great challenge, my great challenge, is nothing other than in the face of eternity and death, a question of kindness. Can I, being alive at this time, love this boy? Can I listen to him? Can I be a good father to this boy? We have glimpsed the future of Mike at 6'3", 250 pounds, his sporadic anger triggering the need for drugs and restraints while I grow older, smaller, and weaker. And Deb and I decided that we want a shot at a different future, one in which Mike, near his beloved waves, maybe isn't so troubled. So after nearly 2 decades in Iowa, we're moving to the coast, to the waves. I have no work there, but I will find work We have no community awaiting us, but we will make one. The people who come to look at our house don't understand this, but it is not theirs to understand. It has not been given to them. It has been given to us. Mike, I say in the darkness, you're a good kid. I say it, and then I keep listening. For once, I don't stop listening after a few seconds as I normally do. Instead, I let the seconds run on. Mike has ceased his laughter now. After some time, I don't know how long, he whispers very quietly, you're a good kid. A good kid. Mike, you're a good kid. I'm proud of you, I say. The words wave and wave, and then they come back broken and then full. Proud, Mike says. I'm proud of you. I love you, I say. It's a profession. It's also a self-rebuke. Love, Mike says a few minutes later. I love you. Love you. I love you. You. After Mike seems to be done with his response, I ask, how would you like to live by the ocean? This brings a big smile. He's looking off away at something far. The words wave and wave. Ocean, he says.
Michael T. Williamson, reading Joe Blair's essay for The Boy Who Makes Waves. More from Joe Blair after this break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Joe Blair is still writing, but he spends his days as a self-employed HVAC mechanic. We caught up with him back in Iowa. That's right, back in Iowa. But Joe, his wife Deb, and their four kids did end up moving to the coast for some time.
Going to Massachusetts, it was on a logical level, on a financial level, a stupid decision. We went out there in the middle of the recession. I was in Local 537 in Boston, which is a pipefitter's local. I had been. That's where I came up. I worked there 11 years before we moved to Iowa. And they had 300 guys on the bench or whatever, and they weren't going to give me a job. And I ended up taking a job back in Iowa after about a year because we ran out of money. I had no great need for Massachusetts, although I love Massachusetts too. I had a great need for love, I think. And we came together as a family moving to Massachusetts. My kids, who had begun to smoke weed and drink and whatever with their friends, and we were having trouble here in Iowa. When we moved to Massachusetts, we kind of became a family again, where we would go see movies together and go and make meals together, and because we were all we had, and it was kind of a renaissance for our family.
While in Massachusetts, the family went to the beach almost every day, even in the winter. Joe says it was great in many ways, but Mike was the same. Ocean or not, he showed no signs of improvement. Mike was diagnosed with tuberous sclerosis in utero. It's a rare genetic disorder where non-cancerous tumors form on different organs, usually the brain, kidneys, and heart. In Mike's case, the disease resulted in developmental delays, autism, and seizures. The family has learned to cope, but they do face new challenges. After Mike went through puberty, he became more violent.
When he attacks you, what he does, he attacks your arm and your hand, and he'll grab it, and he'll pinch it, and he'll twist it, and he'll hurt it. And Deb has bruises up and down her arms all the time. Right now, she has big bruises on her arms. And what you have to do is kiss his hand, and it sounds crazy, but that makes him stop.
Joe says he finds solace in writing, and this essay was his fourth attempt to be published in Modern Love. Life with Mike has given him a lot to think and a lot to write about. When we asked whether he worries about being so honest about the difficulties of raising his son, he says that Mike has taught him to care less about what other people think. He recalls one story in particular.
We were walking around the supermarket, and I noticed everyone was looking at me. I was holding Mike's hand, and maybe Mike was a little old for me to hold this hand. And everyone was looking at me funny, and Mike funny, and I started getting angry. I'm like, what? You know, what? We don't have a right to be here. You know, maybe my child's a little different. Maybe, you know, he's not like your kids, but why is everybody looking at us? That's not cool. And I stopped by the apples to get some apples, and I turned to look at Mike and realized that he had his pants down to his knees and was walking around that way. And what do? Well, you pull up his pants, and then you tie his shoes, and you move on. So as far as having an essay out in the world that was exposing, it didn't worry me too much.
Mike currently lives at home and is in a day program. Joe says for the most part, it's been a good experience, but he does worry about who will take care of Mike when he and Deb are gone. He does not want to assume that Mike's siblings will take over.
We've never put that expectation on them. You know, we've always wanted them to live their lives fully and not feel burdened by Mike. But the funny thing is that all of them have Mike in mind for when Deb and I are no longer, and they've talked about it recently. We haven't brought it up, but they have. William, my second oldest, mentioned recently that he plans eventually to be living in Iowa so I can take care of Mike.
Joe says his family has accepted that their lives will probably never be easy, but they have found a way to keep living with dignity and with grace.
The ocean isn't going to fix Mike, and you know, riding dolphins isn't going to fix him, and electromagnetic therapy, music therapy, you know, there's a fine line between giving up and accepting who Mike is. We haven't given up, and we have accepted who Mike is, so the two can happen simultaneously.
Joe Blair. His essay is For the Boy Who Makes Waves. Joe's memoir, By the Iowa Sea, was published in 2013. After the break, some thoughts from Daniel Jones and Michael T. Williamson.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building, find an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times. He says it's always tempting to sugarcoat a difficult relationship with a child, but Joe Blair does anything but that.
That is just such a profound statement of honesty, and the way he sort of digs deep to admit that and to wrestle with it. I feel like this is the Modern Love column at its best, where people admit to human vulnerabilities and weaknesses that most people would be afraid to admit to because they'd be judged by it. And it's not what you do. You know, you don't talk that way about your children, and you don't talk that way about love being something you're maybe not capable of in this case. And it's a powerful, powerful piece.
Michael T. Williamson agrees.
I feel like my personal assignment as an actor, as I live on this earth, is to open my life up to the pain of others, and to try and help audiences to understand, which I think reduces the opportunity for judgment. And I feel like that's my personal mission as an actor, is to help people to understand the lives, the pain, the insight of people who are not normally chosen to be a part of a story. But everyone has a story, and everybody's somebody's child, and everybody deserves love, and everybody deserves to be understood. And that's it. This really, it landed on my heart.
Next week on Modern Love, Kristen Ritter from the Netflix series Jessica Jones.
I like text messages. They fill an ever-narrowing gap in modern communication tools, combining the immediacy of a phone call with the convenience of an answering machine message and the premeditation of email. And if they happen to be from a crush and pop up late at night, they have the giddy rereadability of a note left on a pillow.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Parati, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.